Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
We stick to our plan with a budget for long-term growth. It delivers more investment, more jobs, better public services and lower taxes. But dynamism in an economy doesn't come from ministers in Whitehall. It comes from the grit and determination of people who take risks, work hard and innovate. Not government policies, but people power. It is to unleash people power that we today put this country back on the path to lower taxes.
This is the Debunking Economics Podcast with Steve Keen and Phil Dobby.
Well, it looks like it's back to austerity for the UK because that's worked so well in the past. Less government spending, less tax for some, but actually not enough to compensate for the tax rises that have already happened and the bracket creep, which is still happening. The fiscal drag, as it's called, and he is the fiscal drag queen, as one BBC journalist rather imaginatively called Jeremy Hunt. Although it, you know, sort of puts into mind a picture that just won't go away now. So, is the UK budget 2024 the same old mistakes? And what would a Steve Keen plan for the UK look like? We'll look at that this week on the Debunking Economics Podcast. Well, a 2% cut in national insurance payments will create the equivalent of 100,000 new full-time workers. Improvements in IT will reduce the NHS waiting list without really costing much more. Britain's balance of trade will somehow improve. The public sector will become 5% more efficient. 5% of what? I'm not really quite sure. That was a lot of what smiling Jeremy Hunt was promising when he delivered the budget speech in the UK to Parliament. All these miracles while staying within the fiscal rules that the UK imposes on itself. It used to have to follow the EU's fiscal rules, and it so loves the EU, it is sticking with precisely those same rules. So, Steve, I mean, on all of that, well, I mean, this is a fantasy budget, clearly. But how much can a government spend? I mean, even if we, you know that, as we talked about last week, there's an unending appetite for bonds. Is there a formula in your mind about how much a government should borrow or spend over its income? Let's not use that term, borrowing.
Well, yeah, borrowing is just the wrong term. And it's like a reading through the budget document. Everything is about reducing the debt. The whole thing was if you're a family who's a was it Micawber from Dickinson's writing, the income 94 shillings, expenditure 93 and 11, bliss, income 94, expenditure 24, expenditure 24 and 5, disaster. And that orientation just reads the whole way through the budget. So we'll talk about that in more detail later.
They actually, you know, never do actually deliver this surplus that they're looking for. But I'm not quite sure what we call it. We don't call it debt. But anyway, the difference between spending and over income.
I would have, and that is fairly straightforward. I'd want the deficit to be roughly equal to the rate of economic growth. And again, I've got to put this in context of global warming, but we'll get back to that later. Rate of economic growth divided by the velocity of money. Because when you look at one of the fundamental roles the government has is to provide the money supply. We live in a mixed fiat and credit economy. It's called fiat for a reason, because the government can create money by fiat, which is what it does when it runs a budget deficit. And you would want that money to be sufficient to maintain the level of economic activity in monetary terms taking place in the economy at the time.
Right.
So if you're going to grow by $100 billion of GDP and your money supply turns over twice every year, that's is a totally wrong hypothetical
which
number.
Which is closer to one. I mean, let's just say one. So it,
well, that confuses people because it sort of says people just go straight from the stock of money to the turnover of money.
Oh, okay. Well,
say it was two. You're going to grow by $100 billion, then you've got to create $50 billion. of credit fiat money if all the money growth is in the fiat money, and then you might make that smaller if there was credit growth for actually sensible things rather than Ponzi schemes and share buyouts and nonsense like that.
Right.
But the fundamental thing is the rate of growth divided by the velocity of circulation of money. That'd be my target for an economy which was in a tranquil stage of growth, or that's the rule. Okay, so you want that the target should not be the usual obsession that Tories have, and unfortunately Labour's picked up the same disease, that your expenditure should equal your income as the government. Your expenditure should be greater than your income as the government. And that is what then enables, that what creates fiat money for the rest of the economy to function on.
Yeah.
And if you don't provide that, it's like telling a car, you know, you should drive your car further and faster with less petrol.
Yeah, exactly. So okay. if you don't pump that money into the economy, then you are just ultimately you are just going to slow GDP because there's not the money there for people to spend. So,
and in fact, you can actually see this data. I'll just, pardon me, jumping in, mate. Mm. But the FRED database does a nice job on this front. And we economists have given up measuring the money supply because they've never understood it properly. They've stuffed up. It never behaved the way they thought it would. It's because they've got a fallacious idea of how money is created from both the private sector side and the government side. But if you take a look at M3, and this is a FRED database, the United States FRED database, makes it very easy to access this information. It's got a very monetary aggregates in their components, broad money in components, M3 for the United Kingdom. That's what it's called. I could try reading out the actual abbreviation. MABB, MM301, GBM, 18189S. That's pretty easy to remember.
Just Google it. You'll find yourself in the FRED database.
Yeah, that's right. What you see is that the rate of growth of the money supply at the moment in the UK is minus 5%.
That's the rate of growth of the money supply. So the money supply is shrinking.
It's going negative. Okay, yeah, yeah. So we're going to – we'll have to talk over the real versus nominal stuff at some point. But fundamentally, there's no economy has ever grown while it's had a shrinking money supply.
Yeah.
And what we've got at the moment is a shrinking money supply, and the government is talking about reducing its contribution to the growth of the money supply and says, let's got to grow at the same time.
So do you know what? That concept, as you've just described, and, you know, we've talked about this in the past, and you know, you break it down to a pub conversation to make it easy. You can't grow if there's not enough money. You can't spend any more than you earn. You can't earn any more if your company can't pay you more. The money has to be circulating. It has to come from somewhere. And if the government is pulling money out of the economy because it's trying to control its spending, then that money is not coming to you. So the economy slows down. So the idea that there's a formula that even, you know, institutions like the Institute of Fiscal Studies, if they could see the sense in all of this, as you describe, that it's the velocity of money multiplied by related to the GDP that you currently have, that becomes, you know, the fiscal rule that you apply, which is, you know, might be 3 or 5% growth, depending on your velocity of money and what GDP is. But I mean, that sounds like a very credible rule. And yet, you know, the government's spin obviously is very much on getting public sector borrowing down to zero. It rose, and the thing is, they never achieve it. So I wonder what you're describing is almost happening by default. So it rose to 15% of GDP during the pandemic, of course. Now it's about 4%, even by 2028-29. It's down to 1%, you know, based on their forecast, their fantasy forecast.
Yeah.
And maybe they plan to reach zero after that. I don't know. But, you know, we know we'll never get there. But they're not even expecting to get there. So here they are. So even though we say it's a false hope, it's the wrong thing to aim for, here they are saying, but that's what we are aiming for. But by the way, we can't even get there anyway. And thank God for that, because from what you're saying, if they do get there, then they're just going to shrink the economy. But can you go the other way then? Can you say, well, okay, we want GDP to go up. Simple way, we'll just create more, we'll just put more money into the economy. That's going to find a home. If you do too much of that, if you go too far above that ratio that you're talking about, then presumably the repercussion for that would be inflation, wouldn't it?
Well, it's actually what I'm worrying more about is the implications on the trade deficit, because again, the government is focusing on its deficit, but it's not the only deficit in the economy.
Mm.
You've got the government deficit, you've got the private sector deficit, and you have the trade deficit.
Yeah.
And the sum of the whole three has to equal zero, because you know what falls out of one rises in the other. And so if you have a government which is trying to run a surplus, that means it's – the terminology gets confusing. A trade deficit is different – is not the same thing as a government surplus. But the government, by trying to reduce its deficit – has to increase the deficit of the other two sides. Mm. And the only compensating one is, and this is why it's confusing to talk about a trade deficit, if you export more than you import, much more, then you can counter the government running a tight budget. And that's what you can see in the health performance of the Nordic countries and a fair bit of the European Union.
Because the new money
well.
That would have been created by the government has now been created by the imports.
By net exports.
By money coming into the country. Yeah.
Yeah. Now, what the UK has, of course, is massive net imports.
Yeah.
Its imports are of the order of 90 billion. It's quite a substantial fraction of a continuous trade deficit, a balance of payments deficit, and that means you've got to be either issuing bonds which are paid in a foreign currency or selling local assets to enable that to continue. So the government, by trying to reduce its deficit, is actually putting pressure on the private sector, which either has to borrow money from the banks or spend less, or unless you have a compensating increase in exports, which is not happening, you're going to have a lower level of GDP.
Yeah.
And the inability to think in a systemic sense is what just the budget reeks of it, because it's all the way through. Just like the thing that I expect Starmer's government to do when it takes over, which is treat the government like a household.
Yeah, no, absolutely no difference whatsoever. So when we look at countries that have got high levels of exports, and Norway is a great example, isn't it? Because here's a country that, it's still got debt, but it's old debt from before, it started making money from North Sea oil. Now, obviously, it's getting a lot of money from hydro and alternative energy sources. And they do still borrow money. But actually, the main reason that they borrow money is they borrow money because they can get it at a good rate, and then they can pass that on so they can offer lower rates to consumers and to businesses. So taking advantage of their situation and taking advantage of the situation that they are basically a net exporter. So they're in a favourable position. So that's a problem for countries like the UK, isn't it?
Yeah, the decision to go in the directive of services exports, which was made by Maggie Thatcher back under her rule, as regarding services of the growth for the prospect of the future, manufacturing will decline, we're going to become a services powerhouse. It never works because fundamentally what services were is selling debt to other people, and not government debt here, but private debt. So when you take a look at what happened around that time, private debt in the UK used to run at about 60% of GDP, and from 1980 on, it rose from about 58%, looking at a chart, obviously, to 184%. And over that period of time, government debt was declining, and the government's congratulating itself for it. Then the turnaround occurred, and guess which year? 2007, the beginning of the financial crisis. Government debt then exploded from about 44% of GDP to 140%, the peak being reached during the pandemic. The reason that the government debt fell was rising private debt. Again, they've got to think in a systemic sense. And now the reason that the government debt is rising is private sector debt reached its peak and a Ponzi scheme collapsed fundamentally, a global Ponzi scheme. And now we've got very weak private money creation. And so the government's forced into the gap whether it wants to or not. So we have a, again, it's the failure to think in a systemic way and then imposing non-systemic thinking on the system by trying to reduce your debt. You're reducing your money creation. You're forcing the private sector to do more with less, which sounds rather Maoist, and it fails.
Yeah, well,
the economy ultimately shrinks.
All about do more with less, which obviously is a very conservative way, isn't it? It's like, let's make our money.
Only when they apply it to the poor.
Yeah, for sure, absolutely.
So they want to do more with more when you talk about their own mates.
So this systemic thinking, this systematic way of looking at it then, if you are a country like the UK where you don't have high net exports, you've got a trade deficit, then the only way, as you say, to get extra money pumped into the economy is coming from the government. And is there a problem with saying that? If everyone's saying, Norway and the UK both say, look, we'd like 4% growth next year. Norway says, well, that's fine because we sell a lot. So we're going to hit that target without the government spending very much. And the UK says, well, we don't sell anything overseas these days. So what we'll do instead is we'll get the government to spend to create that extra money into the economy. Is the UK disadvantaged in any way from that situation?
It's disadvantaged by starting from the trade deficit situation. I know that this puts me completely out of step with the MMT argument here. And this is one time I'm happy to be out of step with MMT, because they argue that the exports are a cost and imports are a benefit. That's the little line they use. And I think that contradicts their arguments about the creation of money overall. It emphasizes the physical rather than the monetary side of things. And when you have a government, if you are continuously in a trade deficit and you are not the reserve currency for the planet, then at some point you're going to be forced into devaluations or asset sales and so on. So you have to be careful your government money creation doesn't spike a huge level of imports. And that's what I see as the constraint, not the government debt itself, what it does to the critical balance you can't control as much as you can the others, which is the trade situation.
So if you've got, I take your point. So if you're not making anything and the government says, well, okay, that's easy, we'll compensate for all of that because we'll create all the money that would have come from exports. You put money in people's bank accounts and go, well, we don't make anything. We've got to buy everything from overseas. So you start a spiral.
So you want to do as much as you can to make sure that is spent on domestic goods. And again, this is one of Keynes's arguments too, that a major reason for wanting to design the Bank Corps for international trade was to reduce the size of trade deficits. Then we had Milton Friedman's magical money arguments, which were totally fallacious.
Milton Friedman did at least argue, that we've got to take into account the amount of money.
But he misunderstood how money is created completely. Right. And that the whole idea, helicopter money argument, effectively says the central bank creates the money by dropping it into the economy. The way the government creates money is by spending more than it gets back in taxation. It does not borrow. This is the most frustrating thing about reading this bloody document. It doesn't borrow. It sells bonds equivalent to the deficit it has run. And the funds that are used to buy those bonds by banks in the first instance, which is when the bonds are first sold, that money, those funds are the balancing item on the banks, the ledger of the private banking sector, the asset side. Their reserves rise. The reserves rise equivalent to the increase in the size of private sector bank balances, because when the government spends more than it takes back in taxation, it's injecting money into private deposit accounts. That is balanced, as I said, by reserves rising. Reserves didn't used to earn interest and can't be traded. When the government offers bonds for sale, it's actually an asset swap. It's not a borrowing at all. So that's what drives me crazy about reading this. And everybody in MMT world as well finds it just ludicrous to see this inane partial analysis, which treats the government as if it's a household, and where households by definition can't create money unless they're running a counterfeiting scheme. The government is supposed to do that. It's what a fiat currency issuer does.
And there's a table in here which really demonstrates that. Table 1.1, changes in borrowing since November 2023. And it's got the line saying, well, okay, this is the change in debt interest spending, which was since November 23. So it's got the debt interest for this year is minus 11.5. This is in billions of pounds. For this coming year, minus 16.2. billion, 2025 to 26 minus 14.7 billion and so on. So all of that, it means that there's, the net position of the government is worse. So what do you do? Well, you obviously have to cut spending. So welfare spending next year to help compensate for that increase in interest spending. Welfare spending is down by 1.4 billion. The year after it's 4.6 billion. The year after that is 3.3 billion. 2.6 billion the year after that. Here we are with the country on its knees, National Health Service, waiting lists, huge people going to food banks. The response to all of that is because we've got all this extra debt interest we've got to spend because, we're passing money on to the next generation. We need to cut on that welfare spending. And that's just totally wrong, because, as you're saying, that debt interest spending is actually an injection of cash into the economy.
Yeah, yeah.
It's on the wrong side of the balance sheet, really.
It's completely wrong-headed thinking. So that's what's so frustrating about reading it. But on the other side, in terms of what you, if you want to impose limits on government money creation, it's first of all avoiding inflation, which is one the element that MMT always acknowledges. But in my, what they don't acknowledge, and this is what my point of difference, you don't want the government boost to cause the increase in imports. Because that is what ultimately weakens a national economy. And all the arguments the neoclassicals make about comparative advantage and how you best to specialise, which is what Britain pretty much did by specialising in services 40 years ago under Thatcher, is not borne up by the empirical data. When you look at it, what I'd be using as a guide to saying what the industrial policy should be for the UK, which is something that the budget has some impact on, it'd be the Atlas of Economic Complexity. Harvard University maintains it. That's a sheer data analysis, unfortunately restricted just to imports and exports as the data source rather than total production, because they use what's called the SITC database of trade classified by different product groups. But you take a look at that, and that fundamentally concludes that the more complex an economy is, the more that it's capable of producing its needs, the more resilient it is, the more it grows. And again, yeah, I've got to come back and put the caveat on growth with global warming, but it's self-sufficiency that actually leads to growth.
Yeah, and it's easier to get that complexity if you've got a big population. So 65 million people, it's easier for the UK to do that than for Australia to do it, for example.
Yeah. And that's one reason why the UK is up at the, you know, it was number 4 in terms of the measure of economic complexity the Atlas puts out. It's now number 8. Wow. It fell as low as 12 during. So, but its trend is, you know, you don't want to be losing that high position. If you have an economy which can produce the vast majority of what it needs, that's what gives you the rating of complexity. And that means a capability to produce anything. So if demand rises, you can absorb that domestically. Rather than demand rising, you end up importing.
Yeah.
And Keynes' idea in designing the bank hall was to avoid that situation of excessive trade deficits. And part of Milton Friedman's nonsense was that when we deregulate the private financial sector and we float all currencies as well, getting away from fixed exchange rates, price adjustments, exchange rate adjustments will take care of all the imbalances and there'll be no trade deficits and no trade surpluses. Well, can I say bullshit on this program?
Yeah, you often do.
I do, indeed. What has happened is, of course, we've got countries running, you know, 10% of GDP surpluses and others running, you know, 5% and 6% of GDP deficits. There's no way that price adjustments have taken care of that. So we've got the same dilemma Keynes tried to address, and that's one of the dangers, that you don't want a boost to government spending to cause an increase in imports and weaken your economy on the trade balance of payments side of things.
And Britain really does face a risk with that, because this strategy, well, it's not a strategy, is it? There's no way you mentioned the idea of an industrial strategy. There's absolutely no mention of strategy in this document at all. We're a bit late taking a break, but I want to talk about that when we come back. It's the Debunking Economics podcast. Me and Steve, back in a moment.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number 1 in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
This is the Debunking Economics podcast with Steve Keen and Phil Dobby.
So So we've talked about, Steve, how important the balance of trade is, because this year imports are up by 14.6%, exports only up 9% in the UK. So the situation's getting worse. But next year, according to the forecasts, a miraculous, of course, this helps the figures in the budget, a miraculous turnaround, imports will be down 0.4%. We'll be actually buying less in the UK from overseas. And exports will be up 0.5%. And exports just increase after that. Amazing! Whilst imports don't increase by anywhere near as much. So we've got this fantastic turnaround, which is great, isn't it? Because this is exactly what Britain needs to do, you know, for the reasons that we've been talking about. If it can get money coming from overseas, it doesn't need to have the government create quite so much. It's got a healthier future. It's got a growing economy. And we can all look forward to that. The only thing that isn't mentioned, obviously, is just the small point of, you know, how are we going to do that?
This is table 1.2 for those who are wondering in the document. And like, it's quite crazy when you compare the actual numbers, 9% increase in exports in 2022 and 14.6% imports. And then the next year, it's -0.5 and -1.4.
Yeah. Fantastic.
And then you should say that the
I wonder what's happening. I wonder how he's doing that. He must have a plan. He just forgot to mention it. And yet,
maybe he's sending some Tories overseas. They've got large amounts of money. They could probably sell the Tories for a large amount on the open market.
Yeah, maybe that's
there'll
it.
There'll be plenty of for sale after the next election.
Maybe it's Boris Johnson's speaking circuit that's actually going to recover the economy. But I mean, that's from what you've been describing, this is pretty fundamental, and yet it's sort of glossed over.
Well, the figures are fantasy figures. Mm. I mean, was it Yogi Berra who said it's very hard to make predictions, especially about the future? So I have a certain sympathy with this. But the numbers, you just look at them and think, hey, what's going on here? So like, we've got consumer price inflation 2022 is 9.1%, 7.3% for 2023, which is pretty much mentioned. Then it's 2.2, 1.5, 1.6, 1.9, 2.0 out to 2028. And this is just the fantasy numbers of a neoclassical economic model turning up, because they basically see the center of gravity of inflation being 2%. So it adjusts towards that. And all the other numbers most likely are driven by those expectations about inflation, which are put into this by the economist running the Treasury. It's a fantasy document. We should really be submitting it as a script to Hollywood.
Yeah, exactly. No, they wouldn't buy it. They'd go, no, we've seen this one before. We've still got last year's script and the one before. Exactly. No one believes it anymore. That inflation number is not going to come down from what we've been saying. So if you don't see that balance of trade improving by that miraculous amount, and so the government is having to pump in more to try and keep the country afloat, then that's not going to help bring down inflation at all from what you're saying, you know, because it's going to, the one thing it's going to do is going to weaken the pound for a start.
Yeah. And it's the incredibly partial view of the system. And this is, again, system dynamics as well as modern monetary theory, says you've got to look at all the various integrated components of a system. Mm. And the rule for, the position for the monetary system is the sum of all equities is zero. Your increase in financial, if your financial liabilities increase, then my financial assets increase, and they precisely cancel each other out. So if the government is trying to reduce its financial liabilities, it's going to reduce the financial assets of the private sector, and then it's telling the private sector to spend more, which will only happen if the private sector thinks, oh, well, I've got to follow the government budget here. In fact, the government, they're likely to spend less, which means your GDP is going to fall, not increase.
Well, they can't spend more if the money's not there. I mean,
You can spend more, but you're going to have to spend more rapidly out of the existing money supply. And when you take a look at what's been happening over time, largely, I think, in response to the increase in private debt, which has been caused by this obsession with reducing government debt, people are more worried about, when you borrow money from a private bank, you do have to pay it back. You can't print your own. You do face all the risk constraints that the budget mythically thinks the government faces. And therefore, if there's less free money around for you, which was what effectively government money is, because it's money that, spending exceeds taxation in the aggregate, people's bank accounts increase with no increase in their liabilities. So for individuals, that actually is like debt-free money. And if there's less of that, you've got to take on more debt-based money, and you get caught in another bloody Ponzi scheme.
Yeah.
And so, again, it is It is highly unlikely people are going to spend more rapidly when the government's creating less money.
Yeah.
They're more likely to spend more slowly, so what adjusts is not spending up, but GDP goes down.
Because they haven't got the confidence in the economy, absolutely. Yeah. So the way, of course, that the government can solve all of this problem, although it doesn't make any difference, actually, through the system that you're describing, is that they save money by being more productive. If they do that, of course, then the problem is that they are not spending as much, so there's not as much money in the economy. But the public service productivity is currently estimated by the Office for National Statistics to be 5.9% below pre-pandemic levels. The OBI is suggesting that raising public sector productivity by 5%, you'll tell me 5% of what, because I'm not quite sure what that is, that's just a percentage, would be the equivalent of £20 billion in extra funding. I mean, so two things. It's not £20 billion in extra funding because that money doesn't exist. It's just been, you know, theoretically saved, but it's not money that's going into the economy, so no one wins from that. And what is that 5% of?
This is what I experienced with the Australian Public Service when I worked for them very briefly, I think in the 1980s. It's a long time ago. But this was a trick that was done to reduce the deficit every year, to allegedly reduce the deficit. You'd have what they call an efficiency target, and you presume a 5% increase in efficiency every year, which meant effectively a 5% cut in budgets every year. And what it did, there's no efficiency rise coming out of that. It's just people not doing things. Mm. I'll give my favourite example of that. This is my ex-university, Kingston. I had no secretarial staff. That was, when I look back at my predecessors 40 years ago, they had quite a bit of secretarial support. No secretarial support. I had to go to the dean's office to sign a set of forms, though, because the dean's staff did all that work. And then there was a reorganization to move the dean's staff to the vice chancellor's staff. So the dean lost his staff. I'd lost my staff already. And I started getting his emails saying, please fill out these expenditure levels, provide the expenditure codes, and send this document back to us. What expenditure codes? It turned out one of the bureaucrats in the dean's office used to, against every spending item, record what that item was in terms of the budget allocations. And suddenly, and she was probably paid about £30,000 a year to do it. Suddenly, me on £88,000 a year, that became my responsibility. I said, pig's ass. I sent it back to them. But what the efficiency actually means not doing stuff and then passing the cost of that onto somebody else or providing a poorer service.
Yeah.
And so that's what people have been experiencing.
So we can, exactly, we've had efficiency in the NHS service, haven't we, by having more people die because not doing stuff.
Well, that's a high rate of turnover.
They looked after my brother this week, and I'm immensely grateful. You can't knock the NHS when you see it in action. That's the one thing. It might have problems at the edges, but when it gets to doing the important stuff, they're still there. But they are going to make the NHS more digitally enabled, and it's going to become the most productive healthcare system in the world, Jeremy Hunt says. So there's a big step up. Let's just go, again, no actual, apart from they're going to use digital technology, they're going to use AI, artificial intelligence, because that's the world saviour to so many things, isn't it? So that one's sorted out. And then the big promise, a tax cut for national insurance. Now, people outside the UK won't quite understand this. You pay national insurance if you work. You pay tax based on your income. And then if you're working, you also pay national insurance on your income as well. That's being reduced, so an additional 2% reduction. They say the OBR, the Office of Budget Responsibility, expect that as a result, the total hours worked will increase by the equivalent of 100,000 full-time workers by 2028 to 29, of which the majority is a further increase in hours worked by those already in work. So that implies that the average worker is regulating how much they work by how much they're taxed. And if you just reduce their tax by 2%, that's going to make all that difference, and they're going to create so much work, so much extra, that is going to be the equivalent of 100,000 full-time workers. None of that sounds plausible at all, does it?
No, I know exactly where that's coming from, because I recommend people to have a look and just see how mad the thinking is behind mainstream economics, to search for a paper called Some Observations on the Great Depression by Edward Prescott. Now, that It's a paper published by a Federal Reserve branch in America, and it might not sound that important. Prescott was one of the winners of the Nobel Prize for economics Nobel Prize, which is not a Nobel, but we won't go there, for inventing the type of modelling economists now do. Now, his some observations on the Great Depression explained the Great Depression as being a fall in worker hours done to maximise their utility. Everything is driven in their model by the desire of workers to work. And if you can increase the desire of workers to work, they will give you more output. If you reduce it, you get less output. It all comes down to how hard workers are willing to work. That is, and it's brain dead thinking. It truly is. But that's what's going on there, thinking that, you know, by reducing the taxation level, you'll encourage more working, and then people will increase the number of hours that they work, as if workers have control over how many hours they work in the first bloody place.
Mm.
This is the level of fantasy involved in all this theory.
And yet companies at the same time, if they're working for the government is actually going to say, well, we want you to work less because we've got this 5% efficiency dividend that we've got to meet, so it doesn't stack up.
That's why the budget reads like a bad work of fantasy, because it is a bad work of fantasy.
Yeah.
And it's all based on neoclassical economic thinking, which argues that workers control the amount of time they put into labour, and they also own the firms, and we won't go there, Mulder. It just gets too bloody ridiculous. But fundamentally, it's saying workers working more will cause the economy to grow. So we've got to encourage workers to work more. How do we do that? And say, I'm sorry, workers don't control how much they work. The bosses set how much you work. It's the profitability of the bosses and the investment the bosses are making that is likely to change the level of output in the economy. And you're doing bugger all to affect that.
Yeah.
You're not even looking at the industry sectors that you might wish to grow in the economy, or you're not looking at the weaknesses of the British economy that you want to plug in case some disasters come your way. And we've got, you know, there'll be climate change disasters coming through, and this is the major point that I'm thinking that I'd want to see in a budget, looking at the structural weaknesses of the UK economy for the challenges that lie ahead.
We'll come back to that in a second. So, I mean, the giveaway on that line wasn't it, saying that, you know, that most of it is going to come from increased workers, from those people already in work, which, as you say, they've got no control over. If they try to argue that it would actually be creating new jobs, we might have another question about how that might happen, but that would be more beneficial, perhaps even more plausible. The other thing is, so there's a thing in the UK called ISAs, individual savings accounts. We've talked about this in the past, where you can put in £20,000. If you've got a spare post cash, post tax, you've got £20,000 to spare. Loads of people have got that, of course. Then you can put that into a individual savings account, which gets invested in shares or whatever you want to invest it in. And the money that you make back is free of capital gains. So big incentive for you to put your spare cash into shares. Now, the problem is, of course, they're putting it into shares in the United States, because everyone is. I mean, a big problem for the whole of the world is everyone's investing in the US share market and everyone's seeing it dwindle. So here's some numbers from Reuters in sterling terms. Over the last 10 years, the FTSE 100 and the FTSE 250 have gained between 13 and 17%. There's been a 260% increase over that time in the S&P, and over 400% increase in the NASDAQ. Even, you know, the Nikkei in Japan's up 140%, and Eurostoxx is up 62%, whereas we're 13 or 17% in the UK. So to get over that problem, then there's going to be an increase in the amount that you can invest in these ISA schemes. You can add an extra £5,000 per year. So, you know, that £25,000 in spare cash, but that extra £5,000 has to go into UK shares. So that'll fix that problem. That'll get UK investment going.
The one thing that's obviously been suffering for the last 40 years is asset prices.
Yeah, exactly. No. So that's going to solve that problem. So, and the economy is going to be so much better because of it.
Yeah, I mean, what I would be looking at, and this is why I said I'd want to look at industrial development and so on, is that one of the biggest weaknesses the UK has is its food imports. It imports 46% of the food that British people eat is imported. Now, that's fine when you've got a functioning global agricultural system, but I think the days of a functioning global agricultural system are numbered, given the impact of climate change. And we've seen, like, for example, we know that India a year and a half ago now, I think, banned the export of all rice except basmati rice from India because of a collapse in the Indian rice crops. We are likely to see serious falls in food production capability out of global warming. No idea when, but put it this way, the forecast of what the climate of Europe will be like with an extra 2.5 degrees of warming, and we're currently at 1.7, we're ridiculously close to hitting those sorts of levels, is that its climate would be like the Sahara. So if you go to Sahara, you can forget about food exports from Europe, and therefore you can forget about food in the UK. Now, the UK actually ends up being better, friendly enough, on the rainfall front than continental Europe. So you've got a capacity to continue agriculture in the UK. You better start doing it soon. And you know, and this failure to think about what the future dangers are, that's what a budget should be about. And all of it is just obsessed with reducing the level of government debt. You know, reducing the level of outstanding government bonds, which is a better way to put it, rather than building up the country or improving the situation of the poor in the country. So, and where it's been made to Sam's site worse by the last 15 years of Tory austerity, in austerity fails because holding. This is the other thing I find quite crazy about it. The actual definition of GDP includes net government spending. You get consumption plus investment plus exports minus imports plus government spending minus taxation.
Yeah.
So GDP is part of GDP. Now, if you try to reduce G minus T in GDP to reduce your debt level, you're reducing both the numerator and the denominator. And therefore, the ratio can rise if the impact of the cut in government spending on GDP is greater than its impact on reducing your debt level. And that will occur. So this obsession is just totally counterproductive.
Yeah, it's funny, isn't it? The answer is there. You only need to understand one economic formula, the simplest of them, which is GDP, and see, oh yeah, government spending's in there. If we reduce that, then maybe we're not going to achieve the GDP targets that we want. I mean, that's
because you're trying to reduce the ratio.
Yeah,
you know. You can grow GDP to reduce the ratio, but you're directly reducing GDP by this action as well. Yeah. So it's a crapshoot, and most of the time the crapshoot's going to lose because of the rate at which money turns over and the level of private debt.
So there's no strategy in all of this. That's the take out, isn't it? So if he came and sat and he thought he had that very smug look on his face. And you're right, Keir Starmer and the opposition are not going to do anything different. They still want to stick by these fiscal rules. They still want to get borrowing down. Besides, I mean, good, but at least they have said, well, you know, we want to spend money on some sort of green strategy, which makes sense. So what is that going to entail? And you know, food security could well or should well be a big chunk of that, but also investment in renewables, which is all obviously job creation stuff. And the money to pay for that has to come from the government. A chunk of it has to come from the government. And we have to get our exports up as well. So we have to produce within that deal. We have to be doing something which Europe wants. So that, you know, that's a strategy, isn't it? And you can, so your point is you can fund that strategy so long as you don't get out of kilter with your growth in GDP in terms of what the government spending is, because then that's where you start
and your trade deficit. You want to make that worse.
Yeah.
And very direct ways to improve the food production capabilities of the UK. And that's, I think, is going to be critical at some point. If India decides not to export rice, you don't want America and Russia and Ukraine deciding not to export wheat. And then suddenly, where do you get your wheat supplies? You know, how do you make your buns? You don't. And you don't want to be in that situation, but it's quite likely to apply to any country with huge food vulnerability. And the UK is almost top of the list on that sense in terms of the extent to which it imports the food that it eats rather than producing it domestically.
Right. So you keep on talking about climate change, and I'm glad you do, and I keep on talking about Europe. The other part of the strategy, if you're going to have this, Europe needs to change, but Britain's got to get closer ties with Europe as well, hasn't it? If it's going to export more, it's got to export more to the people who are just across the English Channel rather than on the other side of the world. So that needs to be fixed up as well with something else, which the Labour Party is too scared to talk about. Well, so anything else you'd throw into your budget then, Steve? We know how much can be spent. One final question on that. Does this become a point? Do you just assume debt is where it is now? So anything else, you know, if you say, well, OK, from this point on, government can spend more than it brings in, provided we have this ratio of exports and provided we've, you know, it's in relation to GDP growth. Do we ignore, you know, the existing level of debt?
Yeah, we do. The existing level of debt is the existing level of bonds created by the government.
Yeah.
It's not debt in any sense of the word, unless you're borrowing in it for another currency, issuing, you know, UK issuing bonds in American dollars or euro. That's definitely debt because you can't create either of those. So yeah, it is just a ridiculous obsession, which is a large part of why the UK has gone backwards for the last 25, 30 years. It's in terms of its competitive power and the general wealth of its population. And if you know, you need someone to decide this just hasn't worked, let's change direction. But neither Labour nor its Conservatives seem capable of doing that.
Yeah, we need someone else, Steve, to do it. Not quite sure who, because there's nobody on the political scene in the UK. But I mean, this is not just a British phenomenon, is it? It's happening all over the world. All over America.
You're going to do a George Galloway accent then.
I actually don't think we should have George Galloway as Prime Minister. I think that might be quite divisive for the world. But I mean, actually, in America, they are, you know, and they've got the advantage, obviously, even though they, you know, their balance of trade is pretty sick. It doesn't really matter too much because the trade in US dollars is so huge. Yeah. But I mean, they are spending, obviously, a great deal more than they are bringing in taxation, and it seems to have been working for them.
The economy has been booming, relatively. Okay, mm-hmm. And, you know, this is showing it's not a negative. Okay,
yeah.
The leveling. Japan's government debt's about 300% of GDP. Mm-hmm. All this, the huge levels, are because they haven't addressed the level of private debt, which is outstanding. That's what's actually causing most of the problems.
Yeah.
But nonetheless, you can sustain a ridiculous level if you have a trade surplus, and the UK can't because it hasn't.
Yeah, and Japan is suffering a lot with haves and have-nots as well. And we didn't even talk about that, which is obviously a significant part of all of this as well, because obviously you use taxation not for revenue generation, you use it for wealth redistribution. And no talk about that at all in that budget either, really. In fact, you know, lots of benefits for the wealthy in it, I think.
Mm.
So, which of course, you know, because they vote Tory, what's left of them. Alrighty. We'll catch you again next week. Thanks, Steve.
Okay, mate. Bye.
The Debunking Economics Podcast.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
If you've enjoyed listening to Debunking Economics, even if you haven't, you might also enjoy The Y Curve. Each week, Roger Hearing and I talk to a guest about a topic that is very much in the news that week. It's lively, it's fun, it's informative. What more could you want? So search The Y Curve in your favorite podcast app or go to ycurve.com to listen.